Look, at Hardee's, we think that if you're hungry and you have $5, you deserve a satisfying meal. Like one of our new $5 All-Star Meals, loaded with American classics like a Charbroil Double Cheeseburger, hot dog, fries, drink, even a warm cookie. But hey, if that's not your thing, you can always break out your degree in menu engineering, piece something together from the other guy's value menu. Or just swing by Hardee's, get yourself a real meal. The $5 All-Star Meals. There's no better way to spend $5. Price and participation may vary. Price is higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Tax not included.
Hello and welcome to the eighth episode of the Hope Illuminated podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention and mental health promotion, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Spitzer-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that can help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we are joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I am so grateful you're here. I'm very excited about today's interview. Each part of the year, I'm focusing on a different area of content. And this one, to me, is possibly the most important. And that is, how do we get upstream from mental health and suicide crises? So for the next 4 months or so, I'm going to be focusing on protective factors, how we can get proactive to build up resilience in our mental health. So when those hard times come, we are prepared and we have resources and resilience built in us. Let me just give you a little bit of a framework to think about in our topic today, which is actually workplace wellness. And just wait till you hear the very unique perspective of my interview guest today. Workplace wellness is something that's becoming increasingly important, as she will talk about. Historically, if workplaces were doing anything at all in this space, they were focused primarily on the physical components of wellness, right? So, you know, maybe there would be competitions on how many steps people should be taking each day, or programs to help people quit smoking or reduce their stress by certain types of physical activities. But we're going to be talking about other ways that we can promote a broader spectrum of wellness activities, including, you know, cognitive wellness. How do we continue to learn new things and keep those synapses firing in new ways so that we can always be growing our abilities? And we'll also be talking about social and emotional wellness, like emotional intelligence, how we can regulate our own emotional states and learn from them, and how we can go back and forth in our interpersonal relationships and regulate those relationships in a more effective way and deeper connect to the people that are surrounding us at work and in our personal lives. And that hardly anyone's talking about spiritual wellness. That just seems like woo-woo and out of place in the workplace for many people, but it really does matter. And I'm seeing also increasingly that workplaces are engaging in things like volunteerism and other ways that they can kind of be connected to their larger community and their larger role outside of their work role. So it's really exciting. One of the main reasons that I brought our guest here today, and she and I have talked about this quite a bit, is that a lot of industries who are not using wellness practices are finding that they have an aging workforce and they're having a really hard time recruiting and retaining young talent. And when I look at kind of the work environment and work practices of a lot of these workplaces that have this aging workforce problem, and then I go to places like Facebook or Salesforce, I mean, it's a totally different vibe. When you walk into some of those tech companies, they understand that the whole person matters there. And so they do things like, you know, yoga classes, and they have tons of really healthy foods around, and they really try hard to create a sense of community that is very attractive to young professionals today. So without further ado, let me introduce our esteemed guest today, who I've had the deep pleasure of getting to know over the last year and has become kind of a co-warrior with me on this effort of really bringing workplaces into the conversation of mental health promotion and suicide prevention. Mary McClatchley is a retired judge. She's had a 15-year judicial career before she founded Work Smart Partners, And I really encourage you to go to her website, Work Smart Partners, and look at some of the resources that she has there. She's best known for offering counsel on state-of-the-art compliance, and also really focusing on wellness and team culture as a way for companies to reduce legal exposure. So that's the kind of the unique piece of this conversation that we'll be bringing today, this combination of her expertise in wellness and also employment law. She's a former senior administrative judge for the state of Colorado and also general counsel to Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And she and I have really partnered together around some specific projects, and it's just been a joy. We've started a company called Resilience at Work, and again, I encourage you to look that up, resilienceatwork.net, and you'll see a quiz there that any company can take to assess their mental fitness, and together we also offer training and consultation to workplaces that want to grow in this space. So without further ado, let me introduce my friend, Judge Mary McClatchy. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you, Sally.
Yes, I'm
delighted
so glad that we were
here
able
today.
Yay. Tell us a little bit about your path. Like, how did you get to this space, and why are you so passionate about this topic?
Well, in my 20s, I was a grassroots organizer before law school. And at age 25, I co-founded the Women's Leadership Training Institute, kind of solidifying all of my social change work, and became a trainer in the community for about 3 years. And then I went to law school, returned to Denver, worked in the city attorney's office, did private practice, family law, employment law, business law. And after that, I went to the Colorado Attorney General's office, where I became general counsel for the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, and really dug deep into civil rights and employment law. After that, I became an administrative law judge for the Colorado State Personnel Board, and for 15 years I presided over and mediated civil rights and employment law cases. And I noticed in that position that probably the most difficult issue for employers to deal with is mental health issues at work. And I saw a real pattern, really just a horrible pattern of silence.
Can you elaborate on that? You're fine. Can you elaborate on what kind of mental health issues people were struggling with?
Yeah, actually, I think I'll fast forward to at the end of my 15 years as a judge, I decided to take an early retirement and start my own business. And I really went back to my training roots. I think I'm a classic boomer in that regard. I just decided that I really wanted to follow my passions to improve workplaces. I wanted to work on work-life balance and flexible work programs, and I have a really preventive law and mediator perspective to creating great workplaces. So when I started my business, I was really able to put all of my passions together. And one of the things that I wanted to focus on was mental health issues. First of all, I do have lived experience. I have PTSD from childhood trauma, and I've successfully managed my own anxiety my whole life. And so I know the issue from that perspective, but from a judicial and from a mediator perspective, and also from a human capital management perspective, what I learned and what I saw is that the prevailing approach to mental health conditions at work is one where everybody, as soon as there is a potential problem, everybody shuts down. And it's a silent spiral, resulting in high costs for everybody and nobody wins. What happens is, as the employee condition worsens, sometimes their performance declines, the manager sees a performance issue, not a health issue, and avoids talking to the employee, instead using the performance management process. This can actually add additional stress, of course, to the employee's life, and so their performance tends to get worse. as the trust and the relationship between the employee and the employer, and specifically their direct supervisor, worsens, the employee feels more isolated, often feels harassed, and managers simply do not know what to do with these cases, and HR doesn't often know what to do with these cases either. So the employee will go on leave, see a mental health provider, come back with their paperwork, and then the ADA and the Family Medical Leave Act are triggered. And at that point, it's very often too late to actually engage in meaningful discussions around accommodations. So it can result in a separation of employment, litigation, et cetera. So I set about really doing a deep dive in the research on how can I present the business case for early mm-hmm. detection. Yes.
No, I was just going to say nobody wins in that scenario that you just presented. I mean, it's just across the board frustrating, antagonizing, isolating, conflictual, fear-based approach. And so when I love when I present this model to people, because the lights go on. Like, this isn't how we have to do it. We can do it a different way. So to share with us the alternative.
Absolutely. So the alternative is actually not a complex one, and yet it's one that people tend not to think of. And it starts really with establishing a total wellness culture where managers, HR, everybody understands all the different dimensions of wellness. And they understand that by providing the right context at the team level, by providing information on confidential resources for employees, and by making the connection with the employee stronger very early on and stepping in, leaning in as soon as they see that an employee may be struggling, that can change the entire outcome, and it disrupts that silent spiral and cycle downward. And employers are absolutely loving this training because it provides everybody with a path to help the employee get well, stay well, and return to full productivity quickly.
And I just want to emphasize a word that you mentioned there that I feel bears repeating, and that's mindset. So this isn't just let me check the box and, you know, make sure I got all my total wellness things in for the month. This is a pervasive set of values, a philosophy that an employer would need to embrace so that it's trustworthy, so that it's credible to the employee. Can you talk a little bit about kind of your experience of that, the difference between kind of this value-based structure versus just, we've got the EAP, so we're covered?
Absolutely. Well, right now, managers, the last thing on their minds is, what does the EAP do and how does that possibly relate to me? And what I really want to do is actually back up and talk about some of the data that I present to employers. And I first laid this all out at the Colorado Culture for Health Conference in 2015. And then I spoke again last year. And the difference between speaking in 2015, where people responded, oh, my God, this is interesting. And then last year, we are so ready for this. Yes, of course. The shift in the workplace right now is really extraordinary. And people are ready to embrace total employee wellness. So what I do is, in terms of the business case, I put it all together. Employees who are thriving in all areas, including mental and emotional, and not just the physical area of their wellness, they miss 41% less work due to poor health. They are 65% less likely to file claims against their employer. And they are 81% less likely to seek out a new employer in the next year. And that's according to Gallup and HealthWays.
Wow.
I also, yeah, it's extraordinary. And
In terms of the legal risk, I don't know that the legal departments are at the point where they're thinking strategically with HR, with leadership, with middle management. But EEOC claims involving depression increased 56% between 2003 and 2013. And in December 2016, less than a year ago, the EEOC issued its first guidance for employees who have mental health conditions and need protection under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And they also issued, at the same time, guidance for their healthcare providers. Managers simply don't know how to handle these cases, and they're not thinking strategically about it. As you said, Sally, they're coming from a place of fear or judgment because they're not trained to understand.
Yeah, and exactly.
That mental health conditions
are treatable, right? We're on the same page. I mean, all they hear is this negative data about lack of productivity and absenteeism and problem. Yet they don't have any skills, or they don't know what to do about it, and so there's just this whole avoidance of it. And so I think one of my main messages is, how do we elevate the conversation and let people know, A, how pervasive these things are, whether or not you think they're in your workplace, they are, and that there's tons we can do to prevent these kinds of outcomes. So go on.
Exactly. I think employers really don't understand how, number one, how common mental health conditions are, 25% of the workforce, right? A quarter of everybody listening to this.
Right.
And half of us in our lifetimes will have a condition that warrants treatment. But moreover, only 30% of employees are getting treatment, and the majority, most wait 3 to 10 years to seek help. And yet, and this is the only slide that I put in red for my trainings. 85% of employees treated for depression have improved work performance. And employees treated for depression have a 40 to 60% reduction in absenteeism and presenteeism.
Yeah.
And treatment outcomes are exactly at the same level as physical conditions. And so when managers hear this, they're hungry for more. They want to know, okay, so how do I get in there and make this happen? Because they really don't know what to say to employees who are struggling. They're nervous. They don't want to say the wrong thing. They don't want to violate the ADA. They don't want to, quote, trigger an ADA claim. Sometimes HR tells them not to do anything, just to use the performance management process. And again, as I've said, that actually exacerbates the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Those classic fundamentals of resilience are front and center in these cases. Employers need to strengthen connections with employees who are struggling, and they also need to not catastrophize the situation. They need to understand this is a temporary situation. It's fixable. This is not someone who's broken and I need to get rid of. In addition, yes, this may be a challenge that I'm not accustomed to as a manager, but I can handle this. I have the skills and abilities to handle this. So
that's fantastic. So really the managers and the supervisors are really kind of the heart of changing this workplace culture. Can you talk a little bit about your approach in developing wellness at the work team level?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're right, Sally, that managers are the front lines, and they are the make or break of these cases, both legally and in terms of human capital management outcomes. They're the difference between things working out with the employee and things not working out with the employee. So my approach with managers first is to give them very concrete tools. How do you have the conversation? What are the do's? What are the don'ts? You don't need to know exactly what to say. It's fine for you simply to say, you don't seem like yourself. Is there anything I can do? How can I support you? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing I do is I provide them with lists of accommodations for many different types of impairments that can arise from mental health conditions, and they're very subtle. There's a lot of overlap, and these are classic management tools that managers can use at any time. And we talk about the fact that we're all different, right? People pay big money to do the DISC assessment and Myers-Briggs to figure out how to manage across differences. And this is no different. You're going to have people on your work team who may be LISCers, and you may have other folks who are really disorganized and have very poor executive functioning. Well, you know what? These folks may actually have a diagnosable condition, but you don't want them to have to come to you and disclose a condition and ask for an official accommodation. But the ideal scenario for managers is actually for them to understand these accommodations are classic tools that they should be utilizing for people across the spectrum now and early. And I give them a list of these accommodations without anything about diagnoses, anything about impairments or mental health conditions. And I just say, here, guys, use this now. You know, think about how you can use these with your teams now, and no one's going to need to come to you. And if somebody is really struggling, then you've normalized using these tools at the team level. And they love it. They are so delighted. And then I follow up my – oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say I want to go back and emphasize something you said earlier, because you really made the point, like, this does not have to be complicated. If you learn how to start these conversations, the outcome almost immediately starts to shift to something more positive. And so I want to reiterate the part that you said of how you start this conversation. You can say something like, you know what, lately you don't seem like yourself. Sometimes when people don't seem like themselves, sometimes it's because they're going through some hard times, and I'm here to help you. What are some things that we can do together to help you be successful here? Are there things that we can tweak for you? Are there resources I can connect for you? You don't have to get into the weeds of what's going on in their personal life. You don't have to expose any kind of diagnosis. And by giving them this art of having to have these conversations and the tools on how to tweak the job so that maybe, you know, definitely the essential functions stay, but they are able to pull it off in a way that they weren't before because of things that were going on in their personal life. So that's like the 1-2 punch, having this compassionate, connecting conversation and then some very practical ways for them to continue to be successful.
Exactly. And then I walked them through several case scenarios. And one of my favorite stories, Sally, is when we were sitting down with our friend from the Employers Council, and she told us about an employer who called her up and described a young man who had been a top performer, and he was tired, he was looking disheveled, he wasn't as focused at work, and nobody knew what was going on, and they were all worried that he was having some horrible mental health crisis. And she said, well, you know what, just why don't you ask him what's going on? And they asked him, and he said, well, we just had a baby. And so I teach employers that, you know, don't be shy about connecting and asking. And you can always talk about, how can I support you to do your job? You know, let's talk about what's going on. And I tick through all the different things that could be going on for people. A divorce. A divorce is an absolutely seismic event for many people. It can throw some people into alcoholism or drug abuse or depression or anxiety. Some people are losing custody of their children. Everybody knows that these things happen. But managers...
And it's happening to 40% of marriages. You know, it's
thank you.
You know, a common thing that people are going through, but it's traumatic, upending.
Exactly. And, you know, if you – and I give the managers the list of the EAP services they've got, and do they have peer counseling, and what else do they have. And I actually have them read the thing, and then they talk about how, oh, I could refer them to this. And then I give them another scenario. What if they lost – what if you have a wonderful 20-year employee who lost his brother, and his brother is his best friend, and they socialize every other weekend with this family, and he has lost one of the pillars of his life. How do you deal with that?
Well, there's grief counseling for that. So it's really not complex. And yet, because of the way that we've all been raised to not acknowledge that emotional and mental well-being are a part of the package of human experience, we really don't have the language for this. But we actually increasingly do have the resources and the framework. So what I do is I connect the managers to the existing resources. And so that's on the one-on-one level between the manager and the employee. Now, turning to what to do with teams, the follow-up training that I have for managers and HR in addressing total employee wellness is called team-based wellness. And managers are so hungry for this after they've done the initial training because now they kind of get it. And I've talked also about how critically important exercise is, right? And taking breaks, because that's a huge piece of brain health now, is we understand how important mental breaks are at least once an hour or at least at the end of your work, whatever you're working on. So I get the groups together, and these are the managers with their employees. We run through all the dimensions of well-being, including intellectual, physical, emotional, as you said, Sally, spiritual, having passion for our lives and what we're doing with our lives and in our work, et cetera. We talk through all of those and tweaks that people can do every day to enhance whatever element of wellness they want to work on. And everybody shares what they're doing right now. It could be healthy snacks. It could be taking a walk at lunch. It could be doing walking meetings, what have you. And we also talk about workplace flexibility, things that they're using now. And then I give everybody a chart. And they highlight what they want to work on. They list when and how they're going to do it. And it's got to be really doable, something they can start tomorrow. And then they think about how can my team support me in doing this. And then I get all the team members together and they have the conversation. And they talk about what are the ways that we want to work together and engage in activities together on a daily basis to enhance all of our health and well-being. And so,
So awesome. So there's three things here that I want to point out that make this set up for such success. Number one is that public commitment. This is why 12-step stuff works, why Weight Watchers can work for a lot of people, is that when you get to a place in your life where you're like, you know what, I need to make this change, and you tell a circle of people, you're now then accountable to those people, and that's a good thing, right? Because you've got to live into this thing that you said was important to you. And especially when you're doing that with each other and get that cross-group support. The second thing that's so important of what you highlighted is you wrote it down. There's actually something that happens when we write our goals down, when we write our commitments down, the brain goes, uh-oh, this is really important. I better remember
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
And the third thing is, you're really creating commitments around immediate action. This isn't like, I want to lose 50 pounds over the next 12 months. This is, what am I going to do this week? What are you going to hold me accountable this week? We're going to go do a walking meeting, and we're going to take a break after we finish this thing. These are things that you can have that quick, tangible experience of, we're doing it, we're making changes. So, bravo, your model is awesome.
And then once they've done that, and it's so much fun, people get so excited about finding out what other people want to do and thinking about doing a walking meeting or, you know, a lot of people actually at 2 o'clock every afternoon, they leave their desks and they go into the hall and they do a plank together. You wouldn't believe what people are doing on work teams.
I love it.
And then the last piece is ongoing accountability. So it's one thing to write it down, share it, decide, get excited. Yes, it's all good. And then the most important piece is ongoing accountability partners and continuous improvement. So what I ask the teams to do is add wellness
to either their weekly or their monthly staff meeting, and it's the first agenda item. And we're going to spend 5 minutes on this. And it's classic continuous improvement. What are we doing that's working? What are we doing that's not working? What do we need to tweak? Where are we with this? And let's get back on the bus. And so when people know that this is coming up, then they're far more likely to stay on board.
Excellent. Do you have any stories you can share about kind of how this has played out with a group or two, some of the creative things that people are doing to have this team-based wellness approach?
Yeah, absolutely. A number of employers have started having walking meetings regularly. A number of employers, when I talk about the brain science around taking breaks and literally getting up from your desk and walking around, this is very liberating. And for people to have the cover, right, the political cover of their manager buying mm-hmm. into this because they've seen the science, and then they've sat in the room with the manager, and they're going to hold the manager to it too, because the manager, something has for them. It's not just for, you know, the line employees. It's for everybody. This is classic change management. That can be transformational for work teams because they all know that it's great for the employer as well as for the employees individually to actually do this. So I think that the taking breaks piece is really liberating because people just, they don't feel like they're being a slouch. They feel like, oh, I'm taking care of myself. I'm actually growing my prefrontal cortex and my hippocampus. So that's pretty powerful.
What are some of the challenges you've faced? Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, have you experienced any challenges in introducing this to folks? Any pushback? Anything that we can kind of preemptively address for people that are like, yeah, that sounds nice, but we don't have time for that, or everybody's just going to want special treatment, or what are some of the rebuttals for why this is not a great idea?
That's a really important question. It's a critically important question, and I actually went to graduate school for human capital analytics so that I would be able to make the business case for any changes in the workplace that I was going to be endorsing in my work. And I've really studied the work-life balance and flexible work literature. And what works is not what have you done for me lately. What works mm-hmm. is you have to have what are the internal customer needs and what are the external customer needs up front and center? That's got to be issue number one. And then within that context, it's how can we change our work practices? So everything has to have the ultimate customer in mind. So
could you say more about that? Give an example.
Yeah, if you've got a work team and one person is on, responsible for covering the phones every day, all day, that person's likely miserable. And so there's power in numbers. Let's think about how we can cover the phones and as a team help this individual get that piece of the deliverable done, but we have to just take turns to do it. And there are other, say, there's a classic ADA case involving a court clerk who had to cover the front desk, and she was there every day, 8 hours a day, and she developed social anxiety disorder, and she started having panic attacks. And she asked her supervisor just to work a bit less at the front desk. And there were 34 other deputy clerks that could cycle mm-hmm. through this work. And it wasn't the only job that they all did. So it was very, very easy to do. She ended up getting fired, actually, for asking for that accommodation. But if that team had been primed to the concept of, okay, we all need to be a little bit cross-trained. We all need to be have each other's backs. and actually structure the way that we're going to get all the work covered internally, you know, responding to emails, externally responding to the public needs, whatever that is. If you work that in, you're good, you're golden. So that's one way of doing it. And the other way, Sally, that I preempt issues is I talk to the supervisors before the trainings, of course, and I find out what's off limits. So, for example, actually the first group that I did this training for, the team-based wellness, I said, what are your big issues and what are the biggest problems? And she said, actually, half of our people telework and they're really isolated. So one of the things that I highlighted in that training was the importance of social connection as a foundation for resilience. And so, and I've had this also with a number of nonprofit clients. How do they increase those contacts and those social connections and build that in order to mitigate that isolation? But on the other hand, I have a lot of other clients, and these are mostly government clients, who do not utilize telework. They really need to be there at the work site. And so in those cases, telework is off the table, and I don't even talk about it because I don't want to throw the supervisor under the bus. So I start by basically telling the group, okay, these are the things, this is the world that we're going to, that we have, right? This is the structure we're working in, and we're going to maximize everybody's potential for wellness and well-being and flexible work practices within the structure that we have.
Wow, that makes total sense, because if the manager is the main person you want to be buying in, to be kind of lifting this up and making it a priority for the work team, you do not want to put him or her in a place where they can't deliver on an expectation that really compromises a lot of things for the whole thing to be successful. So this pre-implementation consultation, where are the biggest pain points, and what can we not introduce here, is a great way to start this trust that you have in changing the culture. I want to go back to this idea of special treatment, because this is something that I hear rumblings about when we're doing accommodations or other kinds of things. Like, people are just whining, so they're going to get special treatment. Can you address that?
Yeah, well, number one, under the ADA, everybody has to continue doing the essential functions of the position. And no employer is required by the ADA to eliminate an essential function of any position. So I think that the ADA has gotten a bad rap, and I think that a lot of supervisors are afraid to even have reasonable accommodation discussions because they're afraid that they're going to have to eliminate something. So I think that's a piece of where the classic whininess issue comes in. But again, prepping your work teams so that everybody has that mindset of, you know what, my turn's going to come. We need to really join rank around Bob now, you know. And again, you cannot breach confidentiality. And that is a real problem, because I think a lot of employees have had their confidentiality breached. A lot of workplaces are very informal. They're small. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everybody's stuff. There are ways of addressing this. Supervisors have to be able to tell their work teams, you know, sometimes I have to make accommodations and they're required under law, and I can't tell you why, but you have to trust me. That's number one. And so people will be primed really not to ask. And then number two, if you've got a good work team and people are, they understand the give and take and they're cross-trained, when you make those tough decisions and somebody else is given an office for a while and everybody else is in a cube and they really do feel the resentment, hopefully they're going to understand, okay, well, you know what, there's a legitimate need for this, and it isn't favoritism. And that is something that is difficult for a manager to address, and they just have to basically
they have to have that foundation of trust.
Excellent. Yeah, and it needs to be this ongoing conversation so that when the person says, listen, I can't give you details, you have to trust me, there's trust there. They're like, okay, you know, when it's my turn to fall apart, you know, because of my life circumstance, I know you'll be there for me too, and you won't spread my business out to people who don't need to know. So that's really an important piece. So, Mary, as we're coming to the last part of this, I wonder if you have some specific takeaways or action steps or things to think about for our employers that are like, you know what, this sounds really great. I have no idea where to start, or what are some things I need to be thinking about at this stage to kind of bring this total wellness to my workplace to get these kinds of outcomes? What would you say?
Well, I will tell you, Sally, it's interesting. There just isn't that much out there. I mean,
right.
I guess what I would say is this. I will be uploading some tools for employers to accompany our podcast today.
Great.
I would say that I have some fabulous tools on my website. And I would also say that the American Psychiatric Association Center for Workplace Mental Health has
fabulous
resources. Lots of data. They have a free monthly newsletter, and that is a tremendous resource. But one of the surprising things is just how unusual the work that we're doing is, Sally. So there really aren't a lot of resources out there.
Yeah, and I think we talk about, too, like sometimes you don't know where to start if you don't know where your gaps are. So maybe step one would be to take that mental fitness test. How mentally fit is your workplace to see, you know, how good am I doing in cultivating a fit and resilient workspace? And then where do I resonate with the energy and the resources that we have to start something? You know, maybe it is this team-based wellness consultation and training. Maybe it is the managerial, how to have effective conversations training. Maybe it's more doing some, you know, needs assessments, some small group discussions about where are our pain points, where are we strong, what do we think about the resources? One of the things that I've come to learn in working with workplaces quite a bit is they just do this check the box thing in their head about employee assistance programs without ever fully investigating what the resources are there. And if we're trying to promote proactive mental health, we don't want people accessing the employee assistance program only when they're in crisis. We want them accessing employee assistance programs when the problems are small, when they're more manageable, and just what it, you know, of course you would need some support around it, your parenting your teen. That's a hard thing to do. And kind of encouraging that ongoing health practice like we would, you know, go to see your dentist a couple times a year, or, you know, going to work with a physical trainer, you know, those kinds of concepts.
Exactly.
So if we start with this gap analysis, a place to kind of assess where we are and where we need to go. Can you talk a little bit more about the process of that, about how we get employers to do that self-examination without fear, without shame, just kind of an audit, if you will, of their own current mental fitness?
That's why we designed the tool, because we wanted people to be able to know what they may not know. I think that's where employers are right now. You know, they just don't understand what are the right questions that they need to be asking. And so that tool, I really feel, is a great education piece as well as a roadmap. It provides a roadmap in their minds. They can tick through, okay, so interesting. I'm doing that really well. But you know what? Over here, not so much.
Right. So again, that's at resilienceatwork.net. It is, it'll take maybe, I don't know, 5-10 minutes to work through. It's a very quick screening tool, and we've organized the questions. So having employers look at upstream mental fitness, what are the protection factors, midstream, how are we connecting, identifying problems as they're emerging and connecting people to appropriate levels of care, and then downstream, how do we help our employees with their life crises and suicide? So an employer can quickly get the gist, like, am I prepared or not, and then where should we start? So if that's the first step, maybe kind of getting a sense of the lay of the land, the roadmap, what might be another takeaway for employers who want to get started in this area?
just give us a buzz, and you know, we can really sit down and talk through on the basis of that initial assessment piece. How can we build on their strengths, and what are the gaps that we can help them fill? And then it's pretty simple to just get in there, sit down with leadership, assure that they're on the same page strategically and they understand the legal and business case for total employee wellness, and then what kind of management training do we need to roll out? And we have to get be sure that management and HR are on the same page. And then, again, it's rolling it out at the team level and at the line level and creating those mini cultures on work teams, which is really where the rubber meets the road. And what that does really is it drives participation and utilization of their EAP, of their existing wellness programs, et cetera. And so they're getting more bang for their buck that they're already spending.
Great. So I'm just going to summarize that. So the takeaways are, number one, do a check-in. Where are we? What's the gaps? Where the strengths? Number two, really getting on the same page with leadership about the strategy and how that fits into the legal and business case. And I would also add in there, in those early stages, how do we measure this? How are we going to measure that what we're doing is effective? What are our benchmarks? So we can, you know, pivot and turn a little bit if it's not going how we want to. And then the third piece is really implementing at the team level so that so those immediate effects can be made. It's not just something that's happening at the top. All right, so Mary, I'm going to summarize some of our themes here that we've been talking about. And as I do, I want you to think about what some of your final thoughts might be as we go to wrapping up. So we started talking about the fact that wellness, workplace wellness, isn't just about fitness and nutrition and quitting smoking and managing weight. Total wellness at work incorporates many other things, cognitive wellness, emotional and social wellness, and even spiritual wellness. And this is really pushing workplaces going, you know, we're just trying to get a job done. We just have this mission over here. Well, do we really have to do all this other stuff? And our answer is, if you want to retain and recruit talent, and if you want to have your company be at the most productive it can be with really happy, engaged, and loyal employees, this is also something we have to do. And it's good. You know, we're making healthier, more dedicated employees, which is important for a company to stay viable. So that's kind of the framework that we're working in. I loved how you shared your story, your journey coming through kind of this grassroots social change framework and also this incredible background in how to develop effective training programs. Those things are coming together now in the work that you're doing with WorkSmart Partners. To really advocate for people and their well-being, but also to deliver these trainings in a way that are most likely going to lead to successful change. The thing that has stuck out to me over and over again working with you, Mary, is your concept of the silent spiral. And we're going to have that graphic, if that's okay with you, on the podcast page so people can see exactly how this happens, of how the silence and the one pony trick of the performance of in a management tool is really doing everyone a disservice as everything starts to fall apart with that process that people think is the only thing that we can do. And what you've taught me is just with some little tweaks, some little changes in how we have conversations and how we manage accommodation, the result isn't just good. The result is tremendous in terms of the outcomes, the level of trust between the manager and the employee, the sense of loyalty for being understood, and so forth. I want to talk a little bit about this mindset because it really does need to come from the top in a way that is permeated and, I say, baked into the culture of the company. How do we set the context for this as a priority that's not just going to be a one and done, not going to be like a feel good, we had an awareness day, we addressed it, now we're going to move back to the hard stuff. How do we kind of constantly check in with folks and shift them from awareness to action so that they fully embrace this and give us feedback? I love your data on making the business case for this. And I'm hoping that together we can put together an infographic that will land on the podcast that we can also push out that summarizes some of these really important data, not only about what happens when these issues go unaddressed or misaddressed, but the more hopeful data of what happens when we're actually doing the right thing. How can we fix the situation? I want to emphasize your point about managers being the pivotal piece in all of this. They're hungry for this. They don't know what to do. They're scared. And if we give them the right tools around the conversations and the accommodations, they can change things really quickly in a very, very positive way. And then we should not make assumptions about what the change in performance is about. You know, maybe it's not about their laziness. Maybe it's not about, you know, something else happening that's derogatory or about a moral failing. You know, maybe it is about a pending divorce, or maybe it's about a new baby at home or a teenager who's struggling. And sometimes some practical assistance around that and some empathy can do the trick in getting people to come back or start to work collaboratively around these accommodations. I think your team-based wellness stuff is the wave of the future, and I'm so, so happy to be with you on this journey as you are working to really implement these and get that those work teams to really hold each other up and bring out their best selves. So that's, I think, what I'm gonna stop there in terms of my summary, because there's just so much, and we'll put it on the show notes with all of the resources that Mary's been talking about, and there's been a bunch of them. So you can come back to sallyspencerthomas.com to get those and whatever else we come up with between now and when we air. Mary, some final thoughts as we're wrapping this up.
Listening to you recap is just really so inspiring. And I think the bottom line is it really is about changing the culture on work teams. It's just that simple. When people watch how others are treated on their work teams, and when they see that someone is treated well and with respect, mm-hmm. and that the team rallies around each other, that brings all boats rise. And that's just the simple fact. And so this is really powerful team building stuff. With very real business, human capital management, and legal compliance bottom line results.
Yes. People watch. People watch how you treat each other. And if you're coming to this with dignity, respect, and compassion, they're going to show up with the same. If you're coming to it with suspicion, accusation, micromanagement, it's not going to go well for very many people. So thank you so much for being such a huge change agent and, you know, shifting a system where most of us spend most of our time, most of the days of our lives. It's such an important part to our life satisfaction, and we can do better, and we will do better. And I'm grateful to be your partner on this. So I felt really inspired by the interview too, Mary. You've been the missing piece for me. I come with a psychology background, and I understand kind of components of wellness, but what I didn't understand was the legal complexities and, you know, all of the perspective you bring of when things go horribly awry for companies and what were the pitfalls they fell into. So I love our teamwork together. I look to the future of how we can build out resilience at work together and really make a difference in these workspaces. Again, come to sallyspencerthomas.com to get the links, the free resources. We've got the mental fitness quiz there. You'll learn more about the trainings that we're doing and so forth. I want to thank our producer, Delilah Jones, for helping us in the background here, and to all of the listeners who are showing up and trying to figure out how do we do workplace wellness better. I really appreciate you leaning into this conversation and then translate some of this to bring back to your own workplaces. You can find, Mary, where should they go if they want to learn more about you specifically and what you're doing?
WorkSmartPartners.com.
Great. So that's the best place. You can find her there. For more episodes of this podcast, please go to iTunes and search Hope Illuminated Podcast with me and subscribe, leave a rating and review. This is super important for other people to find the podcast. So please do that as a favor for us. Once in a while, I'll do a drawing for an Amazon gift card for people who've done that. So there's a little prize in it for the folks that are contributing in that way. And then if you go to my website, SallySpencerThomas.com, you'll also find all the other podcasts that we've been doing over the last while here and blogs. You'll also find information on my Twitter chats and webinars that I'm doing with United Suicide Survivors International. And then please sign up for the newsletter so you don't miss a beat. I'll give you the calendar of all the content that's coming up. And whether you're trying to promote resilience or address mental health problems in your community or with yourself, or if you're dealing with a crisis of suicide, there are tips, resources, conversations there that will be very helpful. So in closing, let me complete this podcast with our motto, open your heart, challenge your thinking, and take action to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living. Until we meet again, take care.
Daddy, where do babies come from?
Honey?
Mommy went to the store.
Oh, well, you see, there's a mommy and a daddy, right?
Right.
And see, when they call Geico, they could save a bunch of money on car insurance.
Oh, really? And that makes them happy?
Yes, that makes them very happy.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could have this talk, Sunshine.
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Look, at Hardee's, we think that if you're hungry and you have $5, you deserve a satisfying meal. Like one of our new $5 All-Star Meals, loaded with American classics like a Charbroil double cheeseburger, hot dog, fries, drink, even a warm cookie. But hey, if that's not your thing, you can always break out your degree in menu engineering, piece something together from the other guy's value menu. Or just swing by Hardee's, get yourself a real meal. The $5 All-Star Meals. There's no better way to spend $5. Price and participation may vary. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Tax not included.